I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, who is today's terrorist? Well, he's likely college-educated, bilingual, and holding a European passport. But first, voter turnout is heavy in North Carolina and Indiana, the two states holding presidential primaries today. In Indiana, only minor problems are being reported. Inspectors were late at two polling locations, and Democratic ballots weren't delivered in two Indianapolis locations, but voters were able to use touchscreen machines. In North Carolina, some voters in Raleigh told the News and Observer who they'd like to see become president.
I voted for John McCain for president and Fred Smith for governor. I just think they're the best candidate.
I voted for Hillary Clinton, and as far as Hillary Clinton, it's the working class and the economy that I'm most concerned about.
I came specifically to vote for Barack Obama. I think it'd be awesome for us to have an African-American president.
I didn't have a preference.
Okay. Why?
I'm waiting for November.
Well, joining us from a polling place in Raleigh, a suburb of Cary, North Carolina, is Rob Christensen. He's political reporter for the News and Observer in North Carolina. And, Rob, you've told us that Cary is a suburb on hormones because it's so big. So tell us more about Cary. Who are the voters there?
Well, it is an affluent suburb. It's about 120,000 people right outside Raleigh. A lot of these people are professional people who work in Research Triangle Park. A lot of them are transplants. The joke around here locally is that Cary, C-A-R-Y, stands for Containment Area for Relocated Yankees. So it trends Republican, but there's still lots and lots of Democrats, and many of them are showing up at the poll.
Well, a Democratic ward chair in Indianapolis, in Indiana, is saying his polling station could see a 55% turnout. That's compared with the 8 to 10% that's typical for a primary. Are you expecting that kind of turnout there in North Carolina?
Well, we are. You typically would see in this sort of primary, without a presidential race, 700,000-800,000 people, something like that, voting in the Democratic primary. Election officials are expecting somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million people to vote. Now, we have early voting in North Carolina, and already nearly 500,000 people have voted, so it's already heavy. But, you know, what's interesting is that so many people have voted early that although voting here is steady, we're not seeing in most polling places stupendously long lines.
Well, what are you looking for? I mean, in Indiana, it's been a tight race, but there was a time when Barack Obama was thought a sure winner in North Carolina. He's won the surrounding states. What are you looking for today?
Well, clearly the race has closed up. I mean, this was in the Obama column early on as a strong Obama state. But what's happened here is we see all happening in Ohio, and we saw happening in Pennsylvania, is we saw a drop-off of support among white working-class people. And that has hurt Senator Obama here, and it's, I think, largely attributable to the Reverend Wright comments and perhaps other issues as well. The question here is Hillary coming on, is it too little too late for her? I mean, she has obviously moved up in the polls. The Clintons have just been all over the state. They have really, really pressed hard. Bill Clinton had something like seven stops yesterday in North Carolina, last one being at 10:30 at night. So they're making a huge drive, if not to win, at least to show that they can at least be competitive in a major southern state.
That's Rob Christensen. He's political reporter for the News and Observer in North Carolina and author of the new book, we should point out, The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics. Rob, we want to have you back to talk more about that, but thank you for your report today.
You're welcome.
Well, we've heard lots in this presidential campaign about gas taxes and ministers, but what about national security? According to a newly released State Department report, al-Qaeda is strong and has replaced its leaders that were either captured or killed following 9/11. Over 22,000 people were killed by terrorists worldwide last year. That's an 8% increase over the previous year. And according to the State Department, an increasing number of groups have established links with al-Qaeda. Well, journalist and terrorism analyst Peter Bergen would seem to agree with the State Department analysis. He's senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the 2006 book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of al-Qaeda's Leader. He met Bin Laden in 97 and interviewed over 50 people who knew Bin Laden well for his book. And in his recent testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, he said, more than at any time since 9/11, Osama bin Laden's deadly organization is back in business. Well, we want to hear more. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
You know, you've said this, but I want to ask you about reports from Josh Myers in the Los Angeles Times that al-Qaeda is fractured, that the second-in-command had to take the unprecedented step of holding an online question-and-response session, you know, to answer criticism about things like the killing of Muslims by al-Qaeda violence. So it sounded ruptured in that report.
Well, Josh's report is not inaccurate. The two things are happening simultaneously. Al-Qaeda is taking a great deal of flack from former militants who were once part of al-Qaeda or groups affiliated with it. It's also taking flack from senior religious figures who once might have been sort of sympathetic to al-Qaeda but have really turned against them. And of course, we've seen this in Iraq, where Sunni insurgent groups have turned against al-Qaeda, but we're also seeing it in other places. For instance, a leading Saudi cleric, Salman al-Auda, has criticized al-Qaeda publicly. Ayman al-Zawahiri's former mentor, the number two in al-Qaeda, his former mentor, a guy called Dr. Fadl, has been critiquing al-Qaeda from his Egyptian prison cell, and there are several other examples. So this is actually quite a welcome development. Yet at the same time, al-Qaeda on the Afghan-Pakistan border and its affiliated groups there, like the Taliban, have launched more suicide attacks in Pakistan last year than at any time in Pakistani history, almost succeeded in killing Hamid Karzai, the Afghan president, recently. Suicide attacks in Afghanistan have gone up exponentially in the past couple of years. We've seen militants from the tribal areas arriving in Spain in January to try and conduct suicide operations, arriving in Germany in 2007 to try and attack a U.S. base at Ramstein Air Force Base, and trying to bring down as many as six or seven American-Canadian airliners in the summer of 2006, a plot directed by al-Qaeda from Pakistan, according to the Defense Intelligence Agency. So this group is getting a lot of flack. On the other hand, it is resurgent. These two things are happening simultaneously. In the long term, the fact that it's taking flack from important religious clerics and people who were once associated with it, I think, is quite detrimental. But in the short and medium term, it's certainly stronger than it was than it's been since 9/11. It's not back to the point where it was on 9/11, but it's certainly regrouping.
Well, you talk about the affiliate groups, and other insurgent organizations have stepped up and announced allegiance to al-Qaeda in Algeria, for instance. And we know, of course, that there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before the invasion in 2003, but then an insurgent group in Iraq announced its allegiance to al-Qaeda. It became al-Qaeda in Iraq. But we also, you know, saw those memos that surfaced that the al-Qaeda command, Osama bin Laden's central command, was having a tough time keeping al-Qaeda in Iraq in line, you know, lecturing them about money that was spent and, you know, too many killings, too many beheadings. So there are these affiliations, but is the center strong? Is Osama bin Laden able to keep them in line?
Well, in terms of al-Qaeda in Iraq, as you say, al-Qaeda Central tried to rein in Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of that group, until he was killed in 2006, essentially saying, stop beheading people, stop killing the Shia, start acting more politically, the Americans are going to leave, remember Vietnam, have a political plan. And that was all very good advice, which fortunately or unfortunately, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi didn't follow through on, and as a result of which, al-Qaeda in Iraq is very damaged. If they'd actually followed through with the advice to behave more politically and not alienate people, they wouldn't be in the very bad shape they're in right now.
But I just want to jump in because you've also said that that was one of the biggest mistakes the Bush administration made, which was hoping that Iraq would draw terrorists, making them easier to kill there. It was the flypaper theory, but that the opposite happened, that Iraq has strengthened al-Qaeda.
Well, there's no doubt that's the case. I mean, Paul Cruikshank and I looked at terrorism figures after 9/11 and before the invasion of Iraq and compared them with after the invasion of Iraq and up to the end of 2006. we found a sevenfold increase in the rate of terrorist attacks around the world after the invasion of Iraq. So certainly the Iraq war fueled the jihadist movement writ large and was sort of a life raft to al-Qaeda in general. So, you know, the picture is complicated. What does it mean for people listening to this program in the United States? I think al-Qaeda Central's ability to attack the United States is pretty low over the next 5 years. They're not back to where they were on September 11th. The U.S. government has made us safer. The American public is more vigilant. And if you look at the planes plot of the summer of 2006, the plan to bring down six or seven American-Canadian airliners, that was al-Qaeda's way of celebrating the fifth anniversary of 9/11. And it took place in Britain because al-Qaeda has a sufficiently large number of pool of sympathizers in Britain to implement something like this, whereas in the United States, it doesn't.
Well, this is where some of the most fascinating and astonishing aspects of your testimony come into play. Who makes up al-Qaeda? You say that in research into known Islamist terrorists arrested or killed, 41% were Western nationals, either naturalized or second-generation Europeans or converts to Islam. More French than the combined total of Pakistani and Yemeni?
That was research done by Robert Leakin, a researcher in Washington, D.C., and he looked at the question of who of the captured and arrested terrorists who were captured or killed in the West, where do they come from? And of course, most of them turn out to be people who are actually residents or citizens of the West. And, I mean, that is kind of surprising, but perhaps not entirely surprising, because to be an effective terrorist in the West, you really need to be able to speak the relevant languages. You need to be able to understand how the culture works.
And you need to know a little thing or two about making a bomb. This was another one that was just astonishing. You studied the biographies of 79 terrorists responsible for five of the worst anti-Western attacks since 1993. 54% of them had attended college, and you compare that to the statistic that only 52% of all Americans have attended college. What does that say to you?
Well, I'd heard a lot about terrorists being produced by madrasas, and since I spent 10 years of my life meeting with people within al-Qaeda or talking to people with associated groups, one thing that struck me is that none of them had been to a madrasa. For instance, none of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 appear to have attended a madrasa. You know, this makes sense, by the way. I mean, if you want to attack the West, you have to be able to speak English. If you're going to be an effective terrorist, you actually have to be sort of educated. And so Mohammed Atta, for instance, the lead hijacker on 9/11, here's a guy with a PhD, ironically enough, in urban preservation from a university in Hamburg. And Mohammed Atta spoke three languages pretty well. And unfortunately, he's really emblematic of the kind of person that is going to succeed in attacking Western targets and has succeeded in the past. If we get attacked again, it's likely to be somebody holding a British passport rather than holding, let's say, a Saudi passport, since European citizens can visit the United States pretty easily. And we've seen British citizens can engage in suicide attacks in Israel in the past several years. We've seen British citizens conduct suicide operations in their own country on several occasions now. And we've seen British citizens willing to commit suicide in attacks against American targets, but that haven't succeeded.
You also write that terrorism is historically a middle-class calling, and that it's more likely to incubate in Europe, where immigrants may have a harder time assimilating than in the U.S. Well, that's journalist and terrorism expert Peter Bergen. When we come back, where is Osama bin Laden? And later, a Mother's Day poem about combat boots and letters home from Iraq and a son at war. That's later today. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from journalist and terrorism analyst Peter Bergen, senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He interviewed Osama bin Laden in 1997. He's written the book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know. And Peter, you write that bin Laden survived the biggest manhunt in history. Where do you think he is? Is he in the mountains on the Afghan-Pakistan border? Has he moved further into Pakistan? Is he sick? Does he have that kidney disease, or maybe diabetes, that was supposed to be making him sick? And is he still calling the shots?
Well, he's not going to die of a life-threatening illness anytime soon. I mean, we've seen videotapes of him. I'm not a doctor, but he looks fine. If he was on dialysis, as has been sometimes said, you know, he'd be dead by now. You know, he is on the Afghan-Pakistan border, almost certainly on the Pakistan side. That's the assumption, the operating assumption. I don't think there's any reason to think that's not true. Is he in charge of the organization? Of course, he's not calling people on the phone because he doesn't want to reveal his location to signals intelligence. But every time he releases a videotape or audio tape, these are some of the most widely distributed political statements in history. And so when bin Laden releases a videotape saying it's official al-Qaeda policy to attack the Saudi oil business, that's one of the reasons we've had a blizzard of attacks on Saudi oil facilities. Similarly, when bin Laden suggests that the United Kingdom might be a good target to attack, a year later an al-Qaeda-directed cell attacks in the United Kingdom. And there are other examples. So but through the medium of these videotapes and audiotapes, Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden continue to provide broad strategic and sometimes tactical ideas to the movement and to the organization.
You mentioned Pakistan. Let's talk about Pakistan. I saw you and author Stephen Cole on CNN. You both seem to agree that President Musharraf's administration in Pakistan didn't really want to capture Osama bin Laden because that would stop the flow of American money funding the search, but that the new leadership in Pakistan does want him caught. Tell us more about the role of Pakistan and also, well, one assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Many Pakistanis believe al-Qaeda was behind that, and the assassination attempt on President Karzai in Afghanistan. Let's talk region. What's the impact of that?
Well, you know, killing Benazir Bhutto, that was a huge success for the militants. Public opinion, you know, has turned against al-Qaeda and against bin Laden in Pakistan because there have been so many suicide attacks, including the one that killed Benazir Bhutto. We've seen Osama bin Laden's popularity evaporate, dropping from 70% last year, favorable views, to 4% just now. Similarly, support for suicide bombing in Pakistan has dropped from 33% to 8% in the last several years. And we've seen around the Muslim world, it's sort of regarded as not a problem until the bombings start at home. We saw this in Saudi Arabia. In May 2003, al-Qaeda began a campaign in Saudi Arabia that produced a 180-degree turn in the Saudi establishment against al-Qaeda, really turning against them. Now, that is yet to happen in Pakistan, which I'm sort of puzzled by. And so the stars are sort of aligned in Pakistan. What's the problem in Pakistan has always been this, which is it's never really been clear if it's a lack of capability or a lack of willingness to deal with the problem. Pakistan is obviously a sort of a weak state in parts of the country, particularly on the Afghan-Pakistan border. We've already been in Afghanistan for 7 years, and the problems on the Afghan-Pakistan border are similar to Afghanistan or even worse. So even if a successful policy is implemented, it's not going to happen overnight, anything like that.
Well, you know, that brings, though, some questions, some things you've said. A poll of Saudis, 49% admire bin Laden, but only 5% want to live in a bin Laden-run state. You just talked about al-Qaeda and bin Laden's polls plummeting in Pakistan. Why hasn't the West been able to capitalize on the criticism of al-Qaeda, that it kills innocent civilians, that it has so many enemies, you list them in your testimony, that it has no positive vision? As you write, the world knows what bin Laden is against, but not what he's for. What's the disconnect?
It's a very good question, because it is a fact that Muslims around the world are turning against al-Qaeda and turning against bin Laden, but the U.S. government can't sort of promote particular clerics or get involved in arcane discussions of Islamic theology. We don't have the knowledge, we don't have the ability, and there's also the kiss of death problem, which is we're also regarded as not being an honest broker in all this. So what the United States government can do in all this is really probably very little.
I want to get to some of your recommendations, and that's one, that the U.S. support the governments in the region that need to solve this issue themselves. But you go on to say that without fanfare, the U.S. should redouble efforts to find bin Laden. Don't make a big deal about it, but just do it. Learn to speak their language.
Well, certainly finding bin Laden would be good. And right now, it's not very clear who in the U.S. government is really responsible for finding bin Laden. So I think the new president should appoint somebody who is responsible for finding bin Laden. Learn to speak their language, of course, is incredibly important. There are only 33 people in the FBI who speak any Arabic at all. There are only, I think, something like a dozen who speak Arabic fluently.
You say a national language institute should be created to train tomorrow's language instructors. You go on to say that the government should create an office of metrics to do what?
Reports which track the following thing. Support for suicide bombings. Where is that going, up or down in the Muslim world? Important critics of al-Qaeda, is that going up or down? Are we seeing fewer terrorist attacks? Are we Are we spending less on counterterrorism operations and counterinsurgency operations or more?
You also say monitor ungovernable regions. Al-Qaeda is already eyeing Gaza, Lebanon, Sudan, Somalia to establish safe havens there, so monitor that. But the last recommendation, chilling, hydrogen peroxide controls?
Industrial strength hydrogen peroxide was the material used to kill 52 Londoners on their way to work on 7/7/2005. It was also the material that was going to kill thousands of Americans and Canadians in the planes plot of the summer of 2006. And it's been really the weapon of choice in the new generation of terrorists who have been educated on the Afghan-Pakistan border. We need to be careful about who's buying this.
Journalist and terrorism analyst Peter Bergen. He's senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of the 2006 book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, an oral history of Al-Qaeda's leader. He also recently gave testimony on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to the House Intelligence Committee. To connect to that testimony and other work, go to our website, here-now.org. Peter, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a filmmaker turns her camera on her deaf parents who decide at 65 to get cochlear implants. Her film asks, why here now? Also this week, Bare Naked Ladies Become Parents. Imagine that. The Canadian band is making a CD for their kids, and it's delightful. We'll have that as well. Still to come today, if you thought measles was eradicated, think again. The highly contagious virus is making a comeback. We'll find out where and why. After the news, Here and Now. Measles is making a comeback. 8 years after it was declared practically eradicated in the U.S., there are outbreaks of this highly contagious virus in several states. The biggest outbreaks have been in New York City, Arizona, and California, but cases have also been reported in Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Virginia, and Washington State. Federal health officials say the U.S. is on track to exceed its worst measles outbreak since 2001, when 116 cases were reported. Well, Dr. Tim Johnson is medical editor for ABC News and a contributor for Here and Now. And Dr. Tim, what's going on? Why are there so many cases of measles?
Most of those cases have been traced to people who were not immunized either for personal or religious reasons, many of them coming from European countries, believe it or not, a lot of them from Switzerland and from Israel. They came into this country without immunization, exposed, transmitted measles. So that's probably the primary source in this particular outbreak. But we've had outbreaks in recent years of mumps and measles in kids and adults who were not immunized. By and large, most of them were not immunized.
Well, let's take a look at that non-immunization issue, because as you well know, people often refuse vaccinations on religious or personal grounds. We know a lot of people associate vaccines with autism. That has not been demonstrated to be true yet. You know, it may still be, but it hasn't yet. Others say there are more adverse effects to vaccines than are reported. So where do you fall on this question of vaccinations?
Well, I'm a big fan of vaccines. I don't think there's any greater public health bargain than vaccines. For the money we spend on vaccines, we get tremendous benefits in terms of prevention of disease and death. Part of the problem, of course, is today's parents don't remember the terrible epidemics and outbreaks we used to have. They're not afraid of these diseases because they never saw them. And so they can be very blasé about them. But those of us who grew up when they were still prevalent, or at least saw the effects of them, no differently. So I'm a huge supporter of vaccines. I understand why parents try to put the two together, autism and vaccines, because they both occur in the same time period in young children. But that's a far different issue than proving that they're causally related. And as you rightly said, to date, there is absolutely no proof that they are causally related. If a person wants to really get up to speed on this, I would urge them to go to the Institute of Medicine's website. The Institute of Medicine is a very independent, non-biased group. They have looked at all the evidence, summarized it, and it's a good way to get informed if you're concerned or confused about this issue.
We'll link to that at our website, so we'll have that for people. But, you know, we mentioned that there are families that also feel that there are other adverse reactions to vaccines and they get underreported. But as you point out, before 1963, when this vaccine became available, there were 3 to 4 million cases and 400 to 500 children a year died?
Absolutely. This is a disease that can kill people. That's hard to believe for many people, again, because they don't remember those days or never saw those days. But this can be a very serious disease, cause pneumonia, brain damage, death. So we cannot take it lightly and just say, well, if I don't get vaccinated, it's all right because others will. We can't count on others to provide the herd immunity that we've had in the past.
Well, and that brings us full circle to where we began, because worldwide we read that measles still kills 242,000 children a year. And so these people from other countries where there aren't requirements are coming here with measles. And, you know, you said, you know, parents may not remember the measles outbreaks. Well, many doctors don't either. We're hearing that doctors don't know what to look for.
Well, they can make pretty good guesses, but you're right. It's going to be tough for them until it's reported as part of an outbreak. An isolated case, the first case in a cluster, for example, may be misdiagnosed. But once the word gets around about many cases appearing, then it usually is quickly diagnosed. But not only parents, you're absolutely right, Robin. Doctors don't remember it, at least doctors in the younger generation.
Well, so tell us, what should doctors look for? What are the symptoms?
The symptoms of measles, per se, are in some ways kind of similar to a common cold, but they include, in addition, spots and rash, red eyes, fever, cough, runny nose. The tip-off to separate it from a common cold, of course, are the skin problems, the spots that show up in the rashes.
Well, and we understand that one of the nefarious things about this virus is that it's so contagious that after a patient's left a doctor's waiting room, it lingers and can infect. You don't have to be sitting across from some child with a rash and spots. So
it's exquisitely infectious. It spreads very rapidly, and as you say, can be spread even after the patient or the case leaves the doctor's office. So that's why it spreads so rapidly in families and in groups and school and elsewhere.
We understand this is why you should, when a doctor suspects there is a measles patient, they should be isolated immediately.
Yep.
Well, so if you've been exposed to measles, if you remember, oh, geez, I was, you know, my child was in a class with someone, and you're not immunized, or the child isn't, can you still get protection afterwards?
You can. It's never too late. And even as an adult, if you weren't vaccinated, it's a good idea to consider it, because you will then contribute to the so-called herd immunity, that is, people who will not pass it on to others. We've also, I'll just mention in passing, had an interesting experience more recently with mumps, where we've had some outbreaks of mumps in college campuses where the students were in fact vaccinated, but they still got mumps. So we're starting to think that maybe we need to strengthen the mumps vaccine we're now giving, and or give a booster later in life. So that's a separate issue, but we're also having some mumps outbreaks.
Well, I just want to finish that thought on, you know, getting protection after you've been exposed, even if you're not immunized. We understand that you can get a treatment of immune globulin, but it's got to be right after the exposure, otherwise it won't work.
That's right. That has to be identified very quickly, and it can help and certainly minimize some of the symptoms if you get it very quickly.
Well, we also understand that health departments are supposed to track all the contacts of somebody with a, you know, a spreadable disease, even measles?
They try to, and they do a pretty good job depending on the resources in a given area, but it can be tough. But, for example, in this outbreak more recently, they tracked down the source of it pretty quickly in terms of, as I said, large groups of people who had come from Switzerland and Israel in particular, where they had not been vaccinated. So they do a good job. And let me just point out one other thing. I think part of the issue here in our society is we're so mobile that parents are constantly moving, and they lose track of their immunization records for their kids. The new doctor doesn't know what's been done. So one of the more ultimate solutions to what's going on is to establish some kind of national electronic records, which we've been talking about for decades, that would also include immunization records so that when a family moves, the new doctor can find out right away what's been done and what needs to be done.
We're reading one story of a family in Washington State. Eight siblings came down with measles. It's thought that they contracted them at a religious conference, which was attended by thousands of people, including people from other countries, and none of them had been vaccinated. I guess it's a reminder as well that you may feel more comfortable in the U.S., although from this report maybe that'll change things, but you feel more comfortable in the U.S. being a no-stick family, you know, not having vaccinations. But if you're going to travel with your kids, you may want to think twice about that.
There are many countries now where it's recommended that you get a vaccination if you haven't had it, or get a booster if you're going there. So you got to check the countries.
Yeah. Dr. Tim Johnson, medical editor for ABC News and a health contributor on Here and Now, which we very much appreciate. Dr. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And staying with health for just a second, we're working on another story here at Here and Now on the price of prescription drugs. A three-month supply of the same drug might cost $365 at one place and $550 at another. Why is that? We'll bring you the answer. And before we go today, another reminder, a mother's poetry written as her son served in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, public health advocates have long warned that a health catastrophe would completely overwhelm the medical system. And now, for the first time, a group of experts is proposing guidelines on what doctors should do. No hospital can afford to build triage rooms that sit empty while they wait for patients. Instead, the panel recommends that hospitals create a new mindset. For instance, instead of one patient getting a blood transfusion, dialysis for failing kidneys, and a ventilator for failing lungs, three patients could get one procedure each, enabling more people to live longer until help can be administered. But also in the report, what happens when doctors have to decide which patients to treat and which to turn away? The panel's recommendations are published in the May edition of the new journal Chest. Dr. Louis Rubinson, a pulmonary specialist practicing in Seattle, was one of the lead authors. Doctor, your panel recommends that people over 85 or with severe mental incapacity not be treated. How bad does it have to get for doctors to make that decision?
50 more people who need a ventilator for every ventilator. So a massive mismatch where obviously care switches to the community as a whole rather than each individual having care simply focused on their particular need. And these are only guidance elements. So the age guidance is somewhat controversial in our group, as is the definition of mental impairment. The intention of that was for someone who has irreversible dementia, who's unable to care for themselves, whose likelihood of surviving critical illness is so low that in that situation, perhaps it's wiser to provide a resource to someone else. It's not intended as anyone who has mental illness or neurologic dysfunction. It's really meant as a physiologic screen of someone who has such poor reserve that we're trying to give other community members a chance to survive. And in that, we actually need some fairness and guidance and standards to make a decision, because if we leave it to the individual clinician having to make that decision, they'll have a hard time knowing how much resource is available because they're on the front lines. And the other thing is, we know, you know, from many studies that clinicians tend to make decisions that are biased based on, you know, what they bring to that situation. So we felt like this was the best way to make sure that vulnerable populations actually get care.
But as you alluded to, it seemed as if it was hard for your committee to come up with this list. As you said, it was difficult to consider age or, you know, severe mental impairment. Do you really think the guidelines are going to, you know, impact a doctor's decision? Aren't they going to also, you know, fall back on you, as you said, on emotion?
Well, what we hope this whole system comes to be is actually a uniform standard, and there's a carrot and stick. So while the protocol that's put out there has gotten the most attention, the age over 85, et cetera, really it was meant more as just a simple protocol in a system that's important. And the system is for clinicians to make decisions of triage, they're going to need to be assured that they're free from criminal and civil liability, because they are changing the usual process of care. And that really rests at the state legislative level. At the state legislative level, once it gives them permission to do so, they should do it in a way that mandates that they follow whatever the guidance the state believes to be most appropriate to make sure that their citizens are best protected.
Are you hoping that your work is adopted by states? In other words, are you giving states a legislative template to work from?
We're giving them a structure for which they can write legislation from. What we really intended to do from the national level was each state was starting to come up with their own protocol, and a lot of them didn't necessarily have all the resources to review the science and to make recommendations on the protocol. So this was really a national function to be able to give them a first-pass template.
Well, let's hope it never has to be enacted. That's Dr. Lewis Rubinson, a pulmonary specialist in Seattle, one of the lead authors of a new report on just how the medical profession should react in a time of pandemic and catastrophic health crisis. Dr. Rubinson, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
Okay, in 1 minute, as Mother's Day approaches, poems from one mom about the difficulty of letting a son go when he's going to Iraq. We'll be right back here and now. Mother's Day is coming, cards and packages making their way to places once or forever called home. And if you're a mom with a child at war, in Iraq, you hold your breath and wait, as Francis Ritchie did.
Last Mother's Day, when he was incommunicado, nothing came. 3 days later, a message in my box, a package. The mailroom closed. I went out into the lobby, banged my fist against the desk. When they gave it to me, I clutched it to my chest, sobbing like an animal. I spoke to no one, did not apologize. I didn't care about the gift. It was the note I wanted, the salt from his hand. The words.
When Fran Ritchie's son Ben joined the Army, he went off to West Point and then to Iraq as a Green Beret, often on missions so secret she didn't hear from him for weeks on end, so she started writing poems. Her writings have been collected in the new book, The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War, and Fran Ritchie joins us from New York. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
How would you describe your relationship with Ben? You have been a single mom since he was two. He's your only child. How would you describe how you both viewed his going to war?
Well, our relationship had become strained because he felt that we should go to Iraq, and I disagreed with him, and that was hurtful to him. And when he came back, he was in so much pain that I looked in his eyes and I saw that I was losing him, and I made a decision that I would not argue with him about politics anymore.
And you've said it's not as if you were a pacifist, you were for the invasion of Afghanistan, but you were against this conflict in Iraq. And also, I mean, you were the kind of mom who kept guns away from Ben when he was a kid.
Yeah, that's true.
You also read a poem about saving him from drowning when he was a child, another with a beautiful description of watching him and other cadets at West Point lifting weights, realizing that these were kids who weren't big enough to play football, but they wanted somebody to see that they could lift a whole family on their back. Were you meaning also that, you know, this is a boy who became a warrior, maybe in part, to lift up his single mom?
Actually, there was a moment when he told me that, and he said to me, "Do you know why I became a Green Beret?" And he said, "Because I wanted to punish those guys who beat you down at work." And he remembered a time when I was trying to buy a car and the salesman was being pushy and rough with me and I was trying to stand up for myself, and he was just a little guy and I had no idea that he was standing beside me wanting to protect me.
And so now, as the story goes along through your poems, you are fiercely supporting him and also praying for him. If you could read the poem, it's titled Thetis. Thetis, the sea nymph in Greek mythology, mother of Achilles, the great warrior of the Trojan War. Would you mind reading some of that for us?
Okay, here we go. Thetis. Her son was going to do what he was going to do. He was headstrong and beautiful and couldn't imagine he would ever die. From where she slept in the depths of the sea, she heard his cry and did what sons despise. She intervened, commissioned divine armor, lobbied Zeus. It's the same when you see your son fall in with a bad crowd. He's 13 and won't listen. So you stop by the school on your way home from work, tell the principal, and quietly, he takes an interest in the boy. Isn't that your job? To whisper in the ear of any god who'll listen. Please, protect him.
Oh, it just a prayer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of the dance that you are doing now with Ben is figuring out how much of his life he wants you to know or he feels you want to know. In fact, there's a poem about that. You visit him in Bamberg, and you want to see him practice shooting on the range. And, you know, he sort of doesn't want you to, but you press him on it, and you explain why. Would you read that, the last two graphs?
Sure. It wasn't about blood or necessity. It wasn't about love. Or maybe it was, all of these, that drove my desire to see how he carried it, if he cradled it, how it fit against his body. To see the side he hides from me, the dark beauty.
But then you do get to see some of the dark beauty, and he says many times to you, you said you wanted to know. For instance, you asked him to go through his gear to show you everything he was going to take with him to Iraq. Why?
I actually did that because I felt that I was going to lose it. I was going to cry, and he can't stand to see me cry. So I felt that would give me some distance, you know, it would make me the observer. And, you know, he didn't bat an eye. He said, sure. And he went through all of his gear with me. And in the poem, of course, you know, as you go further down, the stakes get higher. And then there was that moment where he said, oh, yeah, and battalion wants to know what songs to play at my funeral. He told me that his dad and I would be the recipient of his death benefits. And then he looked up at me, and he looked, I'll never forget that. He looked in my eyes, and he said, you said you wanted to know. And what I felt I was seeing in his eyes was, I really need to be able to go over there and not worry that you're not going to be okay if I don't come home.
It's a devastating list.
It really is. And I've been hearing from other military moms and wives, this actually is one poem that I've gotten emails saying, you know, I went through the same thing. I think it's pretty universal. So many moms all through the ages have watched their sons pack for war. And this watching them get ready, it is pretty devastating.
Yeah. What are, you know, you've been doing readings at bookstores, but also at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, sometimes with your son.
Yes, it's been wonderful, like a blessing.
Well, speaking of blessings and Ben, we understand he's going to be leaving the Army. He's not going back.
No, he actually made the decision recently to separate from the Army. He's served 10 years active duty, and he was feeling a calling to do something else. And he has been accepted at the Haas School of Business in Berkeley.
So you made it.
Yeah, yeah. And let me tell you, I know how lucky we are. I knew that Ben had a lot of training and that he had a good chance of coming home, but luck plays into it too, and there's just really no way to know.
Fran Ritchie, her new book of poems is called The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War. By the way, you're a yoga teacher. Is the warrior both mother and son?
That's a great question. I've been teaching the warrior as a yoga posture for 15 years.
It's a stance where your front leg is bent and your back leg extended as if you're a sword fighter with your arm.
Well, and your arms are like a spear. And what is my warrior next to his warrior? And how much courage does it take to stand on the mat? And how much courage does it take to be a warrior out there in the field, really fighting?
Well, Fran, perhaps we'll leave with a few paragraphs from that poem. And I was thinking page 16 from My Son Has Brothers Now.
Okay. My son has brothers now, the family he wanted. They share the grueling measure of his days, this desert war. 12 around the table, 12 to make the meal. 12 to face the danger, hung from hooks around the ready room, their gear. I tell my students, stand in your strength from a place of openness. But none of us has fallen from the sky, or borne the cheetah marks of urban warfare training, or stanched a wound while bullets fly.
Fran Ritchie's book of poems is The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War. Fran, thank you so much, and happy Mother's Day to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. This will be a good year.